Today is November 29th, 2018, and this is another National Creditors Bar Association Creditors Rights In-Depth Podcast. Our topic today is Canadian debtor-creditor law, and our speaker on our podcast today is Frank Spizzeri. And Frank is counsel at Audax Law in Toronto, Canada, and his practice is centered upon corporate advice, restructurings, debt recovery and dispute resolution. His corporate advisory work includes advising shareholders and directors on such matters as directors and officers' liability and insurance, shareholder disputes, corporate financing and risk management. And his insolvency and restructuring experience includes acting for debtors seeking to restructure their business and operations, acting for insolvency professionals, and acting for creditors seeking recovery. Frank has extensive experience in debt recovery litigation, overturning fraudulent transactions and shareholder disputes, as well as complex commercial matters. He's certified by the Law Society of Upper Canada as a specialist in bankruptcy and insolvency law. In addition to that, Frank's also a prolific writer and speaker. He's spoken at and chaired many programs on bankruptcy and insolvency, debt recovery and commercial litigation in Canada and the United States, and has written numerous articles on insolvency and debt recovery, and has published a book on Canadian insolvency law through the American Bankruptcy Institute. And most notably, Frank is also fluent in English and Italian. Benvenuto, Frank, and welcome to our Creditors' Rights podcast.
Thanks, Mark, and thanks for inviting me to speak.
Excellent. So I know that we have a few members in the National Creditors Bar Association who are based in Canada and who have, you know, work there, but also folks who do cross-border work within there. And I had the opportunity at a recent conference to talk to many of you who are doing both work either in one country or the other country or across borders. So maybe what you could do for our listeners today is we could start out by giving an introduction to a primer on debt recovery in Canada and what are some of the important similarities and differences that you see and you know that exist between the two countries and what an attorney who's in creditors' rights practice might be looking at as far as differences there.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. That's a very good question. So I think as an introductory point, we need to look at Canada and the United States have the benefit of being each other's largest trading partners for decades now. We have the longest undefended border, and we have a long history of cross-border trade, as you've mentioned. So the presence of U.S. parties in Canadian business and the Canadian legal system and the courts is quite common and accepted. Our system of government is very similar, as is our legal regimes, and our general social mores and customs are very similar. Moreover, Canada is, I would say, very foreign-friendly, and so foreign creditors get treated pretty much the same as domestic creditors would be treated, or at least they would be afforded the same rights as domestic creditors would be, and so therefore that's a good thing for American creditors seeking to come up to Canada. What this means, of course, for American creditors or parties in the United States who have issues in Canada is that it should be a very easy transition to dealing with legal matters here in Canada, whether it's in negotiations or whether it's disputes or whether it's general trade, because of the incredible similarities between the two at a very base level. So in terms of similarities, when we look at the most important aspects of the similarities between Canada and the United States, Canada, much like the United States, has a common law-based system. So our laws are drawn from the laws of England, much like most of the United States is, or almost all of the United States is. So in Canada, with the exception of the province of Quebec, which uses the old Napoleonic Code, the rest of Canada uses the common law system. We have an independent judiciary, just like the United States, and we have laws respecting creditors and debtors, and those laws tend to be quite similar between Canada and the United States in principle. In terms of differences, though, debtor-creditor law is within the provincial sphere, which I'll talk about a bit more later on. And yeah, as a result, you're going to see a lot of differences across the country because Canada has 10 provinces and 3 territories, so you're going to see differences across the country. So one of the key differences is the rules that may apply or the laws that may apply in one province are going to be different than they are in another province, much like it is in the United States on a state-by-state
state-to-state basis. Okay.
Yeah. Some other distinctions will also be in terms of the laws that affect the rights of the creditors and the debtors in terms of how they set up their business, how they transact their business, and then how they ultimately resolve their business if it goes the wrong way. If I had one piece of initial advice, therefore, it would be know the province in which you are doing business, because it is super important to know, because the advice that a lawyer would give and the business one might consider transaction might be very different depending on province to province. And there are provinces where there are significant differences amongst each other.
Now, as you're well aware, in the U.S., we have at the federal level the Federal Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. Is there a similar kind of national law in Canada, or is it mainly all just in province by province in terms of that type of governing law?
Yeah, so that's actually a very good question, because we don't have a law that's similar to that at the federal level. And so just by way of background for the listeners, in terms of where the laws are enacted, there is a significant difference between Canada and the United States. So in Canada, we have a federal system just like the United States. There's the federal government in Ottawa, and then we have the 10 provinces and 3 territories. The Canadian Constitution divides all of the powers of government between the feds and the provincial and territorial governments, and there is some minor overlap. So while the federal government has the power over bankruptcy and insolvency, property and civil rights, which is the basis for debtor-creditor law and debtor-creditor relationships, is at the provincial level. So when it comes to consumer protection type legislation, that's going to vary province by province. And so really at the end of the day, the answer to your question is there is no law that's actually very similar to the laws that you have in the United States in that regard, although there is consumer protection legislation as well as laws governing collection agencies and how they are to act with the general public and the debtors they're chasing.
I guess if I was a creditor's rights attorney only in the United States, I'd be racing to Canada now so that I'd have one less layer of law to have to worry about.
I'm going to be honest, and this is a bit off script, I suppose, but the very first event I attended at a NARCA event, when it was called that, was the Creditor's Defense Bar cocktail party, and I was stunned that there existed something as a bar to defend creditors, because that really doesn't exist in Canada. So there are some key differences there. But also in terms of on the collection side, those are also governed by the provincial legislation. So things like homestead exemptions, property exemptions, those will also be covered at the provincial level. And so that's why my initial comment was know the province that you're in, because those things are going to be affected.
Sure. So if I'm a creditor and I've got a claim that I'm trying to file, and I know that we could take this from two different standpoints, so I'll leave it up to you as to how you want to approach it. If I'm a creditor and I'm trying to collect from a consumer who's a Canadian citizen, one thing, or if I'm a creditor in Canada looking to do work in the United States, I think it's probably the other way that is probably most salient at this point, is if I'm trying to collect in Canada and I'm a creditor, so I'm not quite sure whether it matters whether I'm a creditor based in Canada or based in the United States, but what would be some of the first steps I would need to take as a creditor if I was looking for that kind of assistance?
Right. So one of the things I said was that Canada is very foreign creditor friendly. So with the exception of one key difference, and this only is effective when there's actual litigation that has been commenced, there's really no difference between how the Canadian legal system treats foreign creditors and Canadian creditors, putting tax issues aside, which is a whole other discussion point. But in terms of if you're chasing someone in Canada, the first thing we always do is we always ask the question, you know, what's the best vehicle to assist? Should the client be contacting the debtor directly? One assumes that that has already failed. And then the next question becomes, should this matter go to a collection agency or should it go to a law firm for potential litigation? That split always happens at a function of what's the size of the claim and what are the number of claims. So if you're a creditor that has a number of small claims for small amounts of money, it's probably better to go to a collection agency and work through them. And then if the claim is larger or there's a small group of claims, with significant amounts of money, then you want to consider going to a law firm. If we go to a law firm, or even I suppose if you go to a collection agency, usually you conduct some initial investigations. It's important to know the correct name of the debtor, and in fact, I'm dealing with that issue right now where the client had the wrong name for the debtor, and of course we couldn't find it. It didn't exist. So you've got to know whether it's a corporation, whether it's a trade name, whether it's an individual, and whether you've got the correct name. You find that. You do some other searches as well. So, for example, we do corporate searches to find out who the officers and directors are, where the office for service is, so we know that we can serve people in the right place. We also do PPSA searches. So PPSA stands for Personal Property Security Act, just like your UCC. And so you can glean some further information from there. Once you've done that, the first real step one takes is a demand letter. And so we send the demand, usually from a law firm, saying pay within X number of days, or, you know, we may commence litigation. And that usually starts potentially a conversation on either settlement discussions or clearing the way to be able to commence litigation. And normally you give something to the effect of 7 to 10 days to respond.
Okay. Excellent. So relative to the debtor receiving that, obviously now we get to the point where we're talking about settlement and or litigation options for the creditor. And again, I understand based on size and volume, you know, that's going to be determined at that point between either the attorney and the creditor, the agency and the creditor. But what are some of the settlement and litigation options that exist out there for a creditor coming in and
right.
What so, you might be able to work with in terms of a consumer who owes the debt?
Right. So in terms of let's just talk about settlement for a second then. Settlement and discussions can happen at any time, whether it's prior to the commencement of litigation, during the commencement of litigation, even after the conclusion of litigation, whether you've obtained a judgment or not. So settlement discussions are always an opportunity to try to reach a deal without expensive litigation, because we all know litigation is expensive. The courts, the judges are always in favor of settlement and settlement discussions. In some jurisdictions, for example, in the City of Toronto, we have mandatory mediation. So when you commence a legal proceeding, you actually have to attend the mediation session before you can proceed with the litigation itself. So there are opportunities and there is a drive to try to get parties to reach some kind of settlement. If, of course, you can't settle, then you go down the litigation route. The first thing you need to decide is where you're going to go in litigation. Each province is different, but there are some similarities across the board. Each province and territory has a small claims court. And okay. So depending on the amount in the province of Ontario, it's up to a maximum of $25,000. So you can pursue someone to get a judgment for up to $25,000. And sometimes we even tell people if your claim is for $27,000 or $30,000, go under small claims. It's much faster. There's no discovery process, and it's far cheaper in terms of legal costs. If that isn't an option, then you have to go to Superior Court. And obviously, Superior Court in each province is going to be different, but again, very similar to the United States. There'll be a pleading stage where each party gets to put in their claim and their defense. Then there'll be a discovery phase where we don't have trial by ambush in Canada, so every party has to put their relevant documents into play as part of this discovery phase. So you can't hide documents, and each party is allowed to be examined by every other party. So kind of like a deposition, we call them discoveries or oral discoveries. So we have that phase. Once that phase is completed, then you can get ready for trial, and very few cases ever actually get to trial. Most wind up settling long before that. I think in Ontario, it's something like 10 to 15% ever reach a trial. And depending on the jurisdiction and, more importantly, the locality that you're in, it could be years before you get to a trial. And so, therefore, you know, the parties have an impetus to try to settle. One other point is in the province of Ontario, we have something called the simplified rules. So if you have a claim between basically under 100,000 or let's just say over 25,000 and under 100,000, you can still go to Superior Court, but you go under something called simplified rules where there's far less legal involvement, and it's kind of like a hybrid between small claims court and regular ordinary litigation. So there is an opportunity for someone who's got a claim for under $100,000 to have a more efficient, less costly way to try to reach the resolution.
So it's a way to fast track as well as to not clog up the dockets for the judges.
That's correct. Yeah, that's absolutely right. And like I said, it could be in some jurisdictions here in and around the City of Toronto, it could be years before you get to trial.
So I assume that once you obtain judgment on a debtor, and consumer within the litigation process. What happens then? Is there garnishments like there are here in the states? What other options are dealt out by the court for the creditor to be able to recover the funds?
So, yeah, right. So the first step, once a judgment is obtained, is that an appeal period clock starts running. And depending on the jurisdiction that you're in and depending on the level of court you're in, the debtor has, you know, X number of days to, or now the judgment debtor has X number of days to appeal. Province of Ontario, at the Superior Court level, it's 30 days. So they have 30 days to file an appeal. A creditor can take action immediately after a judgment is made, so they don't have to wait out an appeal clock or anything to be able to start to take action, which I'll talk about in a second. One thing that is very important is that money judgments are stayed. So if someone appeals a money judgment, it's automatically stayed until the appeal is heard or the stay is lifted by way of motion, which is on a very, very, very rare opportunity to do so. But let's assume that the judgment debtor appeals, then you've got to go through the appeal process. And again, depending on the jurisdiction, it could be years before an appeal is heard. Sometimes they get heard less than a year, but sometimes it's usually between 1 and 2 years for an appeal to be heard. And if you're stayed because it's a money judgment, you're just going to have to wait out that period, unfortunately. But if there is no appeal or the appeal is dismissed or the appeal clock has run out, as you mentioned, there are the mechanisms for recovery. So the first thing we usually start off with is a judgment debtor examination, which I think they're called examinations in aid of execution. I'm sorry, I'm showing my age here. And so up to once a year, you're allowed to examine a debtor. And basically, you get to haul them in and ask them, do you own this? Do you own anything? Where are your assets? And you can really grill them in order to try to locate their assets. Because the reality is that a judgment is only good if you can actually convert it into cash. And you can only convert things into cash if you know they exist. So that's usually the first step that we do. If we're aware of assets, then we try to seize them using writs of seizure and sale. We have sheriffs just like in the United States, although ours are a bit different, and I don't think they carry sidearms. But in any event, our sheriffs will be able to seize assets and sell them. We often seize real property, we seize vehicles, and we seize intangibles like shares. And so you have that opportunity for writs of seizure and sale. We can garnish wages and garnish third-party payments as well using writs of garnishment. The key thing to keep in mind is each province will have its exempt property legislation and legislation dealing with how much you can garnish. So you can't garnish 100% of someone's salary, and there's certain properties that are assets that can't be seized. Some provinces have homestead legislation. Some provinces do not. So Ontario does not have a homestead legislation. You can seize their home and sell it just like any other asset that you could chase.
Excellent. So how about U.S. money judgments? Can those be enforced in Canada?
So as I was saying, we're a friendly jurisdiction here. So foreign judgments and even foreign arbitral awards can be enforced in Canada. There's a mechanism to doing so. You have to basically commence a proceeding here in Canada and seek an order recognizing the foreign judgment or foreign arbitral award. And once you have that, you can enforce the Canadian the recognition order as if it were any order of the Canadian court. And then you can just garnish and do anything else that you could otherwise do. The debtors usually don't have any real opportunity to oppose, save a couple of defenses that they might have. One, the original court didn't have the jurisdiction to be able to make the original order. So, for example, they sued. Oftentimes we'll see American creditors suing in a U.S. court because they don't want to come up to Canada to sue. They get their judgment in the United States and then bring it up to Canada, and a Canadian court says, well, hang on a second here. The tort happened in Canada. The tortfeasor or whoever the person committed the tort is called is here in Canada. You know, your judgment from the state of Florida or New York is invalid. And so that's one way to strike them down. The other thing is the order comes from a questionable jurisdiction, which thankfully the United States federally and none of its states are considered a questionable jurisdiction. So Americans won't have that particular problem. Or there might be some public policy reason why the Canadian court might not recognize it. But again, that's usually when it's a foreign country with laws that are very different. Here, you're not going to see a lot of public policy restrictions imposed on American judgments if there have been laws validly passed by the states or the federal government. So the short answer to your question is that it's actually fairly easy and fairly common for American judgments and arbitral awards to come up to Canada and be enforced here.
Excellent. That's good to hear. I see we're winding up near the end of our time here, and I know that I'm definitely going to invite you back for another podcast, because I think some of the distinctions, or hearing about some of the distinctions in bankruptcy laws, would be interesting for our listeners in the NCBA. So if you'll be open to that before we wrap up, I hope I can invite you back to give us some insights into the bankruptcy differences between the two countries too.
Yeah, that'd be great, actually. I'd be very happy to do so, because unlike debtor creditor law, which is actually quite similar between the two countries, bankruptcy law at an underlying principled level is the same, but our laws are very different, and the way bankruptcy proceedings are conducted in Canada are actually very different than they are in the United States, and probably does require its own separate discussion.
Great. Well, I'm going to have you back for that. So as I said, we're here at the end of our time on the podcast. If you wanted to have our listeners walk away with some important topic or fact out of our discussion today, what would that be?
So I think as a takeaway, I would advise the following. Try to know exactly where you're going before you might wind up with a problem. So what does that mean? I think what Americans who are considering doing business in Canada is definitely try to understand the laws of the particular province that they're going to be doing business in, because if there is a problem down the road, they want to be able to make sure that they can enforce their rights in a way that allows them to recover. And the reality is that in some provinces it is actually very difficult, or far more difficult, and others it's far easier. And so therefore, as an American coming to Canada, you should know your rights going in before you have a problem afterwards.
Excellent. Frank, thank you so much for spending some time out of your busy day talking with us and sharing the information. I know it's going to be of great use to our listeners.
Thanks, Mark, and I appreciate being asked. And I think the organization is a fine organization. I think you guys are doing a great job, so I'm happy to have participated with you. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Frank, and we'll have you back to talk on bankruptcy.
Thank you.
All righty.